Let's go ahead and get started. We turn now to agenda paper four. Takashi?
Good morning. Agenda paper four discusses the accounting for long-term interest in associates and joint venture that form part of the net investment, those interests that we refer to as long-term interest. When the committee discussed this issue in May, it tentatively decided to develop a draft interpretation explaining the requirements in IFRS 9 and IAS 28 to long-term interest. So at this meeting, we'd like to discuss some aspects of the draft interpretation, and having discussed those, we'd like to ask you to formally vote to give the staff permission to prepare the draft interpretation for balloting. So the first proposal relates to presentation and disclosure, which is discussed in paragraphs 15 to 24 of the paper. As for presentation, our recommendation is to clarify that an entity allocates impairment losses recognized on the net investment between those investments an entity accounts for using the equity method and long-term interest. As for disclosure, we recommend not to provide any new disclosure requirements specifically for long-term interest. This is because we think there are already sufficient disclosure requirements that apply to long-term interest. Questions 1 and 2 on page 7 asks whether you agree with these recommendations. Before moving on to other section of the paper, I'd like to take a pause here and hand over to you for discussion.
Comments and reactions? Nobody? Okay. Oh, Martin, excuse me. We're messing with the microphones here.
As last time, I believe that technically the conclusion is right. However, it is in a way a little bit challenging to get there and to understand how to account for it, and therefore the example is so important. And you worked out on the example, so therefore I'm fine with the first two questions.
Okay, well, I've just, I think, got us back to where we're supposed to be with the microphones. So, Tony?
A couple of thoughts. Yes, I agree that it would be helpful to clarify that an entity should allocate losses. Do we intend to tell them how to do it? Or just say you should allocate?
I think if it would be helpful, we could propose that the order of allocation should follow the allocation in which you allocate the losses to these components of net investment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be helpful to be, if we're going to tell people to allocate, we ought to give them a steer as to how they ought to allocate. And then my second question around disclosures. And I admit I've not spent a lot of time looking at what IFRS 12 requires in terms of disclosures, what IAS 28 requires, and so on. But I thought as I read the example, and I understand that the examples included everything that we could possibly think of in terms of possible scenarios, I wondered how easy it would be to reconcile all of that to what happens to the share of results of associates in the income statement and the line items on the balance sheet. And I think what would be important for users is to say, well, okay, if we disclose under IFRS 12 the results of the associate, but then what's in the income statement is a completely different number, that it would be helpful to be able to bridge the gap. And so my question is, do you think that is required at the moment? And if it isn't, would it be helpful, I don't know whether it's mandating something in the interpretation, or pointing out what folks should look to and what the disclosure objective ought to be. So I guess the question of, do you think the existing standards actually require that bridge?
Can someone turn the microphone on? I can't hear what's being...
I'm sorry, we had a problem with getting them set up.
Oh, no, no, that's all right. My comment is exactly the same as Tony's. I can't follow the example, and the net result of what will appear in the financial statements looks like to me to be just simply the balances, and I don't know that people will follow what the balances actually mean. But sorry to interject that.
That's okay, Sandy. Takashi?
Yep. First of all, I think it is important that entities explain what's happening to the carrying amount of long-term interest, especially after allocating a share of losses to such long-term interest. And as to the current requirements, I think it may be true that there are no disclosure requirements that are on point to these long-term interests. I think there are a number of disclosure requirements that apply to long-term interests. And even though IFRS 12 does not specifically require to provide a reconciliation between the number you get upon IFRS 9 and this interpretation, but the overall objective of IFRS 12 is to disclose financial effects of interest that you have in other entities. And if you follow that objective, and if you feel you have to provide explanation to enable readers to understand what's going on with the carrying amount, I think that's what you have to do.
Would it be helpful to say what you just said,
yeah,
to remind people of it?
Yeah, it could be. And just to quote, by the way, from IFRS 12, the reason I agree with what Takashi said is actually in the overall objective of that standard, the objective is split into two pieces. It talks about providing enough information, to evaluate the nature and risks associated with those interests, but also in this instance, I think it says, to assess the effect of those interests on the financial position, financial performance, and cash flows. So and then we also have words that says, in applying all the specific requirements, if that isn't enough to meet the objective, you should provide more. So I think we could maybe draw on that.
Right. Yeah.
I think that's good. Point taken.
Thank you.
Can I ask a question? Do you think it is important that we do that in the authoritative part of the standards, or it could be done through the basis for conclusion?
No, I think that's guidance.
Yeah.
Don't put guidance on the basis. Bruce?
Thanks, Wayne. My comments were kind of along the same as Tony's. My first question was, we have to talk about the how. I found the same thing as I read through it. It's great, I need to allocate this, but how do we do it? So I think we've got to do that. I was going to go a step further on the disclosure. I actually think we do need specific disclosure. Following up from what was said, I got to the same, almost the same position maybe as what Sandy was saying. When you get to the net result and just see the balances, if we're allocating and how we're allocating across it, I would be very concerned that people just wouldn't understand what you've done. Yes, we can refer to some of the IFRS 12 stuff. We can get there. I'm just concerned that people won't give enough disclosure to understand how we've got to those, to the allocation and the balances. So, I think as much as I don't like putting in new disclosures, I'm a very anti too much disclosure, I just worry here that people won't understand how we've got to that answer.
Okay, let's just go geographically here, Yongsu.
I just concur with Tony and Bruce on number one. We have to specify how to allocate in the impairments. So I have the same opinion to that. But for the second one, disclosure, I think we need some extra disclosure, at least on how to reconcile the opening balances and the ending balances, how the ending balance is coming from the opening balance by including all different impairments. Because in the impairments, for some companies, they will have just one impairment. The other companies will have two impairments. Some companies will have three impairments. So there are so many different between the companies. So I think there should be some kind of disclosure, at least on how many impairments and what amounts of impairments are included in the ending balance of those long-term interests.
Okay. Bob?
I am, first at the outset, I'm supportive of the direction
that we're going. I agree with the points that have been made about telling, about how to do the allocation of losses. I think the, jumping and peeking ahead, the illustrative example I think is, I found it extremely helpful, very powerful in helping me understand through the model. Just one minor point on that. I thought that in period four, a very important point is being made that you can have a reversal of the equity method losses because of an interplay with IFRS 9. IFRS 9 causes a decrease, you can't go negative. You could also have, for example, a sale, cause a gain. I would think then that really is, that gain is really a reversal of the equity method losses. In the example, and I'm not proposing to change the example, that reversal of equity method losses went into P&L because there was no other long-term interest that was above zero that we could go against. I would just like to add, not another example, but something in that discussion there, a footnote or something, that says that, by the way, if there was additional other long-term interest, that reversal would go against that the other long-term interest.
Jim?
Yeah, as we share the same.
Before coming into this meeting, following the clearly laid out paper and examples, we kind of figure out a situation with double counting of the losses, just because of the cross-reference just Bob just mentioned, back and forth between the IFRS 9 and the 28. So we talk about it with Takashi, and we sent him the example we developed, and I think we're in agreement that it could be a double counting situation, and maybe as just Bob mentioned, some period later when you do something with the assets, you could get all the previously double counted loss back by derecognition or by some other situations. I'm not saying that we shouldn't do this, just double counting to me is still not something we should do, and by clearly saying that we should do that doesn't feel right. And I think the kind of previous discussion kind of in tells us if we could somehow disclose this, that should help so that the readers and knows a little bit what's going on.
Just to come in on that, Jim, I suppose I know that obviously you weren't here when we talked about this back in sort of March and then May, and I think in those papers we as staff at least did try to go into some detail talking about the fact that yes, some people thought the accounting meant there would be double counting of losses, and I think from our perspective we didn't think it's actually double counting of losses in a sense, it's just there's two different things happening with two different objectives.
Yes,
when you're doing
impairment
testing in 9, yeah, you're sort of, you know, adjusting the balance to what you think you're going to get in the future. Mm-hmm. Equity method loss allocation is something different. It's just loss allocation according to the equity method, which means you can end up measuring these interests below, for example, their fair value.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's not double counting. There's just two different things going on with a slightly different objective.
Your expression just make me much more comfortable looking at this situation. But
I totally understand.
I'm fine with that. Just hopefully the disclosure could tell the readers what's in it, well, which kind of part of the impairments or just how to recognize them, so that the readers know, okay, that's what's getting into this account. That's it. Thank you.
Jane, you wanted to come in?
Yes, I just wanted to jump in now because it's on the topic that I'm interested in. I can't quite understand yet whether if there is an impairment under both 28 and 9 in the same period, arguably those facts could line up that could occur. It's not clear to me whether you'd get double counting or if it's just double jeopardy. And I tried to deduce that from the example, but it's not clear that there's an impairment in the same period under both standards. There's the allocation of losses, that's perfectly clear. Everything that's in the example is perfectly clear. So I'm still struggling with whether there's a double impairment. And then again, that would seem odd to me that that would occur. Because where you do one impairment and then arguably ignore that impairment when you look at impairing under the other standard. Is that correct? I thought that was what the model was.
No, you don't. So step one is that if it's a long-term interest, you apply the requirements in IFRS 9. So if it's amortized cost, you apply the impairment requirements or you measure it at fair value. Then step two is if the associate has any losses, and you consider this to be a long-term interest, you'll allocate some losses to it. Then the outcome of that, the carrying amount after you've taken account of the 9 and applied the equity method, then it's what's left over as a combined unit then, including your equity method, under 28. Okay. So you're not ignoring the impairment you've taken in 9 when you do the impairment in 28.
So when we're adjusting to fair value on the 9 instrument here, mm-hmm. that's our impairment.
Yeah, I mean that's the maximum it could be when you apply the impairment in 28. It could, your balance could have even come below fair value because you might have done allocation of losses.
When we fair value the IFRS 9 instrument, that's our step in the example where we're illustrating an impairment under 9.
Not the fair value because it's not impairment. We're just so in the example, we've actually tried to hopefully be a bit more complete to include both a long term interest that's been measured at fair value through P&L in IFRS 9 and also a long term interest that's been measured at amortized cost. So it's only the one at amortized cost that effectively you apply the impairment requirements in 9 to. The other one just gets measured at fair value.
And there's an impairment under 9 and 28 also in the same period. That's what I'm struggling with.
No.
Just the vocabulary.
Yeah, we're getting out of order here, but go ahead, Mary.
I think it may be partly a vocabulary thing. You've referred a couple of times to a quote, second impairment under IAS 28. It may not be an impairment as much as it is an absorption of an accounting loss from your.
I allocated P&L losses is we've been doing
right
forever. So that's not the concern. It's getting back to this. I thought I wasn't the only one around the table that thought that the model would lead you to impairing under both standards.
Because of different perspectives.
Yes. So
and I thought that. So you look at IFRS 9, the long-term interest that's subject to amortized cost accounting, and using the IFRS 9 model, you're looking at shortfalls and contractual cash flows using the IFRS 9 mindset, looking at that instrument in isolation. Then what we're trying to confirm is that when you then come to the IAS 28 accounting, you look at everything in aggregate and consider whether, taking into account the carrying amounts you've already got to, including net of impairment in IFRS 9, when you consider impairment in 28, there's an additional impairment that's needed because of the aggregate. But I think actually one of the things that's going to come into play is going to be that because IFRS 9 is now going to tend to have bigger impairment balances because of the new model, it's going to end up with lower long-term interest amounts coming into the aggregate anyway, which I think is going to reduce the risk of this double accounting, perceived double accounting effect that people are thinking about. But the difference is 9 saying, this individual instrument, what contractual cash flows don't I think I'm going to get? And 28 saying, given all of the things I call long-term interest in 28,
plus equity method investments
in 28, in aggregate, is there additional impairment that I need to think
so
about?
So it's a different unit of account that you're testing for impairment in 28.
Right, no, I understand.
And it could happen in both periods. Both could happen in one period.
Both could happen in one period, and maybe I need to go back to the example. It's not clear to me in my recollection. I spent quite a bit of time working on math. It's not clear that you've illustrated an impairment both periods, but maybe
Can I keep going because I already had my light on and sort of build on that?
Please.
It's apparent to me, based on some of the comments earlier, and Jane's comments reinforces it, we're going to have to do a really good job in the basis of explaining how this interaction works and why it's not double counting.
Yeah.
It's different perspectives. Because otherwise, all the feedback we're going to get on this interpretation is not going to be about the mechanics of the interaction between 28 and 9. It's going to be about how the accounting doesn't make sense. And I think we all agreed last time that it was clear how the interaction, well, what the intention of the interaction was, and we're just trying to clarify how the operations work. But unless we do a really good job with our explanation, nobody's going to focus on the mechanics. They're all going to come back with their reactions to the perceived double counting. I also wanted to just say something quickly on the disclosure. I agree that it's really important to try and get a disclosure that enables users of financial statements to understand this, given the potential complexity of all of these interactions. But I'd be keen, at least in the document that goes out for comment, to try to cross-refer to the objectives in IFRS 12 that way, hoping that that means we get good disclosure, but simply because I think if, given that IFRS 12 is objective-based, if we start saying, and by the way, you specifically have to provide these things, it's sort of undermining the objectives in 12, because if we start saying every time we think of something, yeah, you need to add it to the list, it's detracting from us trying to encourage people to step back and take this holistic view of, have you provided the information that enables people to understand that we're trying to encourage with all of the way, all of our disclosure requirements. And I think maybe we could get, you know, specific feedback from people on, do you think it's clear that as a result of the interaction between this draft interpretation and IFRS 12, if this was a material item and complicated, that people would need to provide this disclosure? And if everybody says no, then we can do something about it, but at least we will have tested it.
Yeah, the bookkeeper in me always wants to be able to get from the beginning balance to the ending balance.
Yeah.
Okay, let's try and get kind of back in order here. I have Reinhardt, Andrew, Mattel, Jim, you already came in, right? Carl, and then Young Soo wants to come in again. So let's go to Reinhardt.
My comments are similar to the ones made by others. I do agree on the first question that we should clarify the order of allocation of losses. And in terms of disclosure, my thoughts were consistent with what Sue indicated, that it'd be helpful to point to the principles in IFRS 12 and how they might apply in this circumstance, because I think the thing we're struggling collectively with is how does a reader understand the various impairment losses that are allocated to the items that comprise the net investment. The one other comment that I was going to make in terms of the quote double counting issue, the more I thought about it, I personally think that there is not double counting per se. It may be the same economic events that you foresee in the future that cause losses, but different losses. So you from an IFRS 9 perspective, you may be looking forward and saying, I expect shortfalls on my loan instrument, and therefore I'm going to reflect that in my expected credit loss. Those same events might cause you to do an IAS 28 impairment test at the balance sheet date, which may cause a further loss potentially. And if all else held true, those same future economic events may result in equity method losses that you would potentially have to pick up. So I think the way I look at it is it's those economic events that might cause different types of losses, if you will, on each of the various aspects, the various units of account that we're talking about. So I think that helps me get over that issue. And I think it would be, as you said, Sue, very important to explain that thinking in the base for conclusion, because that'll be, I'm sure, the most common reaction.
Andrew?
On the presentation and disclosure questions, just to add my support, in question one, the word that I wrote down was how, and it would be really helpful to have something which guided people through that when they're reporting. On the disclosures, I'm quite comfortable to see if the staff can reconcile back to what's in 12. It would be helpful if we didn't add anything else on. On the other question that we've been talking about, I'm perhaps in a slightly unusual position because I'm coming to this relatively new and wasn't involved in the committee's detailed discussions in previous meetings. And so it's perhaps instructive just to talk a little bit about what I thought when I picked this up and what I then needed to do, because it may help the staff see what needs to be done. because when I read this to start with, I thought, I just disagree with this. This can't be right. And I thought, well, that's an interesting place to be. Let's go back. So I went back through the agenda papers from previous meetings, the papers that went to the board, and the various bits of discussion, and then decided I was wrong, and I did agree with the staff. However, I think that one of the things that made me pause may be useful to think about in the drafting, because when I looked at the discussion which said IS 28 paragraph 14 confirms that you don't apply it to something, you don't apply 9 to the equity accounted bit, so that's the only bit, I thought, well, I'm not sure that's conclusive, because paragraph 14 sits in the bit of guidance in IS 28 which deals with equity accounting. And so I can see responses coming back saying, you've missed it, that's the bit that deals with equity accounting, you've IS 28 deals with the whole of the net investment. So I started to think a bit about, well, how would I rationalize it slightly differently? And I think the way I'd do it would be to look at the scope out in IFRS 9 a little bit more carefully. Because while it's perfectly true that IS 28 tells you that you have a loss allocation on the long-term interests, it doesn't tell you how to do any of the other accounting. And what you're effectively doing really is you have to account for your long-term interest and then apply the overlay of the accounting for the share profit or loss. And that would then tell me that the scope out in IFRS 9 itself is absolutely clear, because the long-term interest is not accounted for in accordance with IAS 28 at all. It's just an overlay of loss allocation. And therefore, you are automatically pushed back into IFRS 9. And I think that's perhaps a slightly easier way to guide our constituents into what ultimately is the right answer in a very complex web. Because it struck me, if I need to spend quite a lot of time on it, I don't think all of the respondents in their comment letters will go back through all of the agenda papers. So just a thought of how it might be articulated. I absolutely agree with the technical analysis of where we've got to. And I also, while I understand the points and double counting that people have made, I think that we're actually talking about different things. And so I think, as Reinhard said, while the same economic event may give rise to downward adjustments in three places, there are actually three different downward adjustments, and they're mutually exclusive.
Okay. Mikhail?
Yes, I have not get this insight yet. Because I think it was very good with the example and so on, because I think it shows very well that it is double accounting. For sure it's double accounting. And when we look on the IFRS 9 then, or this, that we take a loss year one, that is for something that happens year two. And then year two, we take that loss into account as well as part of this allocation. It is, of course, double accounting of the same thing. So for me, that is a good example that we end up in a situation, a solution that is not good at all. And maybe we have differences in practice or so, but what we then try to do is something that is seems not right, not a good solution. And in addition, I think that we had a long discussion there to fit this into one exception. But if you read the standard here, you can pick different pieces, I think, to support the different conclusions. And my understanding from previous that people have a lot of different conclusions in this area, which means that it's not so black and white. And to my understanding, it's about what is long-term interest then in substance, is that you have a net investment, what is the part of our equity interest in substance. And if you look on this paragraph 38, it says that net investment could be then preference shares, long-term receivables, etc. And in paragraph 41, it says that if it is part of the net investment, it is not in scope for IFRS 9 for impairments. So, I mean, you can come to the conclusion or pick other pieces of the standard to support that we should have another solution. And then, of course, it might be so that that is not the preference solution or so, but to have same thing accounted in different standards from, as you said, from its different perspectives or so, but how to explain that or what is the rationale about that? So I'm not at all in line on this path forward.
Wait, can I respond briefly or would you prefer me to come back later?
No, that's good.
Just one thought, and the articulation that you've gone through, in fact, is one of the routes I went down as well. Because I thought, well, what could be the fix? Because really, in substance, we're saying this is part of the net investment, so are we saying in substance we have an equity interest here? And that seemed a very nice, attractive way to go, because then you could get the scope out from 9 and everything would be nice and the sky would be blue and the grass would be green again. But I don't think it would be operational. And the reason I don't think it would be operational is that a long-term interest doesn't give you an equity interest. And therefore, you would hit a wall when you then tried to apply equity accounting to the overall long-term interest. And that, I think, is probably why the board required a loss allocation and not full equity accounting. So while I would dearly like to get to a slightly different answer, I think because of the mechanics of the way that equity accounting work, as articulated in IAS 28, and the way that the scoping works in IFRS 9, means that we are pushed into the conclusion that we've reached. So I understand it, and I find it a very attractive thing to try and get everything into equity, but I just don't think you can.
Okay, I have Carl, who's been waiting patiently, Young Sue. Sandy, did you want to come back in?
Oh, yeah.
All right, I've got you on the list. And Bertrand. So, but let's start with Carl.
I agree with the additional disclosure requirements we are talking around the table. I would support that. I'm comfortable we are not doing double accounting. However, I have some probably the same level of discomfort about the timing of recognition Jane pointed out. Are we creating a kind of scroll accounting for, in the example, the 30 unrecognized loss in period 4? Are we...
Kind of accounting?
Scroll accounting. Are we... Scroll accounting. Are we keeping this 30 to be recorded in a future period? Is that correct?
That's what IAS 28 requires.
Yeah, that's about the timing, because it was a period 4 loss recognized in period 5.
Yeah.
That's a bit odd.
Okay.
It's a timing discomfort from my side.
Young Soo?
Yeah, first of all, about double counting. I thought I was the only one who claimed this is a double counting in the last meeting, but today I have lots of supporters. I'm so happy about that. I think this is double counting of impairments. What I think is that, you know, IAS 28, when it is printed or made, didn't think about IFRS 9 yet. So, you know, what they think, I think, is that, you know, what the IAS 28 think was that since long-term, the equity method, the securities are not recognizing any impairments, we have to recognize kind of substitute type of impairments in IAS 28, which is the allocation of the losses from the associate companies. So in that sense, I think this is a double counting, but I don't want to revoke our prior decision. You know, we already made a decision that we're going to go for the impairment of IFRS 9 first and then IAS 28. So I just want to follow it. I support the decision. Because of that, I think additional disclosure is more important. As I said, you know, many companies will recognize different types of impairment. One impairment, two impairments, and three impairments, different types of impairments. And also, when I looked at this example, what I found was that some of the numbers doesn't provide any useful information at all. Especially what I'm seeing is page 20, period 3. This is the case when we allocate for subordinate companies, you know, the losses. After allocating subordinate companies' losses, the balance becomes zero for equity securities, zero for the preferred shares, and 40 for the long-term interest, I mean the loans. I believe that these numbers don't mean anything at all.
Yep.
So that, I think disclosure is very, very important. The reason why we have to provide disclosure is that, you know, sometimes the information users wants to recalculate the numbers or restate the financial statements. So we have to give an opportunity to the people.
Hang on, Sandy.
Okay, to that.
Okay. I know, I'm just agreeing.
Okay. Thank you. And lastly, you know, what I suggest, what I want to suggest one more thing is that we need to explain why we have to apply IFRS 9 first and then IAS 28 very, very clearly in the basis of conclusion. When I explained this to many people in my country, they didn't understand it. And the first question they asked me was, why IFRS 9 first? I tried to explain them. And I mean, in the SAP paper, you clearly stated that, but many people don't naturally understand it. So that is my final suggestion.
Okay, let's get Sandy in, and then Sue, and then Bertrand. Sandy, go ahead.
I agree with everything that was just said. You know, I don't think we can simply reference to IFRS 12 and say, oh, you know, make some additional disclosures. I think the comment with respect to adjusting, investors will adjust this to a number they believe is more realistic, is spot on. This is accounting complexity at its finest, resulting in numbers that have no economic meaning. And, you know, I think the point made about period three is a fantastic one because of the fact that you're looking at preference shares that are in theory held at zero but will have a fair value of 40. You know, to me, the example that's included here is missing one important element, which is the fair value of the loan that will be disclosed, because the investors will take the numbers that are reflected in the financial statements and adjust them to their fair value. And so this example doesn't include the fair value of the loan. It also doesn't, in period one, it's a bit misleading to think that the loan is decreasing in value while the preference shares are growing up and the net and there's operating earnings. So I think there's a flaw in the example starting out. So I don't think you can have an impairment on the loan before you can have you know, equity losses and preference shares if we're looking at the hierarchy of cash flows. I mean, I haven't agreed. I get what the accounting says. I just think it produces you know, mishmash of items. I would also include in this example what the net result is after all the adjustments. I know that it's included in words at the bottom of each of these, but putting these side by side and looking at what in fact is the value next to what the fair value, for example, in the preference shares, and adding a fair value for the loan is going to really illustrate that the numbers that are produced are really not very economically meaningful. And for investors, for the disclosure, really, I'm not certain how we do that because of the fact that will these preference shares be aggregated with other items on the face of the balance sheet? Will the loan be aggregated with other items? Will people actually be able to see what's going on with these particular items? Or will it be called out in a footnote to show that, in fact, this equity method, this preference share, and this loan are all tied together? My guess is that it probably won't, and that it needs to be. So some communication with respect to, some communication in the basis of conclusion that shows that there's some disclosure related that's necessary, that shows the relationship between these items all classified in different lines on the balance sheet, I think would be particularly useful. But as I said, in the example in that's included, I think you need to include the fair value of the loan so that people can actually see what's going on with that, because that will actually be a really important element, maybe not to the mechanics of the example, but of understanding what it's doing relative to the market value.
Okay. Sue and then Bertrand.
You might remember at the last Interpretation Committee meeting, I wasn't too excited at the idea of issuing an interpretation on this topic. And this discussion isn't making me any more excited at the prospect. I think the challenge that we've got and the challenge that we had, and I'll talk about the board discussions and not pick on the Interpretations Committee, is that when the staff brought this issue to the board to talk about what was to confirm the intentions of the board in terms of the scope of IFRS 9, the staff had a really difficult time getting the board to focus on the question they were being asked, which is what do the requirements say today as opposed to what would you like them to say. And ultimately the board agreed that it was the intention of the board that the expected credit loss requirements in IFRS 9 be applied to these long-term interests that aren't subject to equity accounting, because I think that's the whole reason why this question's come up now. It didn't matter so much before. And I think we're certainly, speaking as one board member, I'm really keen to get a message out to the market that says you do have to apply the expected credit loss method to those long-term interests. And a number of board members also raised broader concerns about the value of the numbers that would come out of all of these allocation mechanisms that you then get tipped into an IAS 28. But the staff managed to convince the board for now to just at least confirm that you do need to apply IFRS 9 to these long-term interests. So people are doing it as part of their implementation of IFRS 9, which we all hope they're working on at the moment. And I guess the thing I'm worried about is if we get too bogged down in the second question, which we can come back and look at, and the board's open to that, and the committee, I think, will be interested in that feedback as well, I don't want that to prevent us getting the message that we need to get to the market about what they need to do with the application of IFRS 9 and its scope. And I'm just a bit worried that we're going to lose sight of that with all of these side discussions about whether we like the ultimate outcome of applying 28 to these things.
And I think what's coming across to me, and I'm not saying I personally disagree with it, is a lot of people saying, I'm not sure applying the equity method produces information that is sometimes particularly useful. Because, for example, it clearly can't forget about the long-term interest in terms of your just equity method investment. It clearly allocating losses of the associate can write that down to numbers that are very different from what you might sell your associate in the market. So I think what I hear a lot of opposition to is potentially whether we think the equity method actually produces useful information. If I can maybe just add, if it's a bit of comfort around disclosure as well, comfort with maybe the suggestion that we have clearly conversation about disclosure, but we link it more to the objective in IFRS 12, is that in terms of individual impairments taken and anything else, there are actually specific disclosures. So for example, if there is impairment taken in IFRS 9 for these interests, you will have IFRS 7 disclosures. If there happens to be any impairment taken, an IAS 28 impairment, there's specific disclosures in IAS 36. There's obviously these interests and associates also are related parties, the related party disclosures. So I think that hopefully what we can do is, I would think hopefully we don't need to add extra in a sense. I think the piece that we want to try and get across is perhaps in applying, in meeting the objective in IFRS 12, that just kind of, the thing that's specifically missing is maybe that, you know, reconciliation in a sense or something like that, that says can you, you know, how do you piece all those different individual pieces of disclosure together to come back to what is recognized on the balance sheet.
Bertrand, and then I'm going to try and wrap this up.
It will. What I will say will just echo to what Andrew said previously and to what Patrina has just said and it's more a general thought as I'm new here also I entered into more details into this subject and something strike me. If you think of it, there effectively, and it echoes to what you've just said, Patrina. You've decided that even though you have an equity investment to be accounted for in accordance with IAS 28, you will decide that any let's say long-term financial or financing assets, in addition to the value of the shares themselves,
should be considered using provisions of IFRS 9. And that strikes me a lot, actually, because I appreciate what you're saying, Patrina, that many, or some at least, think that IAS 28 does not provide relevant information, but still it exists. And there are specific requirements in IAS 28. And yeah, sure, it's odd because it's a mix between IFRS 9 and IFRS 10. We're in the middle of the two. We don't know exactly where we are in many instances, and notably in this one. And we could have figured out something else than just saying the long-term financing is just in IFRS 9. Why? Just because it's attached to an IAS 28 overall investment. But I totally appreciate that my comment, my general comment, is pointless because of all the discussions and decisions that have already been made so far. And a second thought. I was surprised that also you do not wish. I understand why you do not want to, but I'm surprised that you do not wish to define what exactly is the long-term financing investment you're talking about here in this interpretation. At least we could do a reference to what is within IAS 21 on this. If you think of it, in IAS 21, such investments, let's put it that way, quasi-equity loans, the CTA, the variation of foreign exchange loss or income would be accounted for in CTA, not in P&L. So there you do not apply IFRS 9 requirements. You apply specific requirements. But there you apply IFRS 9 requirements. So it was just a general comment. It's probably pointless, but effectively it quite surprised me that you disregarded the fact that those types of instruments might be specific because they are attached to an IAS 28 investment. And I remind you of the fact that I'm not expressing a personal view on what I will say, but in France people are quite fond of IAS 28, which sometimes surprised me, but they are fond of it. Okay?
Not only
in France, okay. So maybe some, notably in the US, do not like IAS 28. I can figure out why, but in France or in some other European countries, many people are quite supportive of IAS 28. I'm not expressing a personal view here.
Okay. Let me see if I can try and pull a ribbon around this. A lot of this is...
Wayne, sorry, can I comment?
Oh, Tom, I didn't realize you were on the phone. Yes, please.
No problem. Two comments. We fully agree with those who say, okay, the disclosure requirements of IFRS 12 are relevant and should be referred to in the body text. From the whole debate, it is rather clear that the example is rather complicated, and we believe that it is very important that there is a good explanation how these models work. We were wondering whether the staff did some outreach on this model, because, for example, in the country I come from, the Netherlands, there the national standard setter believes that you do first allocate the loss or based on the equity method to the loan, and then the remaining amount is tested for impairment under the financial instrument standard, which is, if I understood the example correctly, the opposite of the model which is proposed by the IFRS IC.
I think that's right. I think that's you described the steps in the opposite order.
Yep.
Of what the what we've come to in past meetings.
Yeah, and I can understand the reasoning, but because I do not believe that the Dutch Accounting Standards Board is unique in this position, there might be a lot of resistance and a lot of misunderstanding, and it was also based on the debate, is there a double counting or not. Countries where they apply the model, like in the Netherlands, they would maybe come to the conclusion there is a double counting here. So it should be very well explained in the basis for conclusion why there is no double counting in this system.
Yeah, okay, let me see if I can try to describe a solution. Jim panicked me when he said double counting. Bertrand, real quick.
Real quick. It was just a remark on the page 21 of the agenda paper. So referring to period 6, in the example previously, nothing struck me at all. But there, what's strike me is the way to re-recognize the financial asset on a kind of weighted average basis. And so I had in mind that you're still, even though it's an IFRS 9 financial instrument, the impairment test logic, triggering events of the impairment within an equity method accounting is IFRS 39 or IFRS 9. But then all the calculation is IS 36. And in IS 36, you allocate the impairment first to the goodwill and then to the other fixed assets or other assets within the company. And there, it seems, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems that it's not the case, that you would do something else. You don't initially recognize the impairments on the equity method investments and then on the rest. And there I was quite surprised there to see that you do not recreate first the loan interest and the preference share interest and last then the equity method interest, but you recreate something that is, unless I've missed something, but I thought it was a kind of recreation of the assets, but on a weighted average basis, let's say, on a pro rata basis.
Bertrand, is your question about what's in the illustrative example?
Yes.
I mean, just to explain, because I think you're maybe questioning whether the illustrative example reflects how you do IAS 36 impairment allocation. I mean, just to clarify.
Not IAS 36, IAS 28. IAS 28, yes. Which refers to IAS 36.
Yes, exactly. Sorry, that's what I meant. No, just to explain, the illustrative example does not include an IAS 28 impairment.
Okay.
So it just shows measurement under IFRS 9, which includes impairment and loss allocation in 28. It doesn't illustrate IAS 28 impairment.
Yeah, but there might be there, or it might be clear. It might be worthwhile then having a stating that it is not reflective of what would happen, whether an impairment should occur in accordance with following the requirements in IAS 28. And by analogy with IAS 36 then.
Okay. We'll think about that one, see what we can do with it. General observation first. Bertrand said people in France and Europe like IAS 28. Others not so much. It's absolutely true. If we knew what the equity method was designed to accomplish, we'd be a lot better off, but we don't. We've had arguments over the years. Some people believe it's a one-line consolidation. Some people believe it's a surrogate for fair value. We never, until we resolve what it's supposed to be, it's going to be hard to say where we think we're going. I thought, and I still believe we had resolved the question of whether or not this was double counting. You may wind up recognizing two different kinds of impairment, but they're two different kinds, and I think we've had that pretty much nailed down. The staff's question was about clarifying how to allocate impairment losses. We started with Tony saying it would be good to say not just that you allocate them, but how. And I think we agreed with that. Then we kind of, I lost track, frankly. A couple of people, Mikhail, disagreed when the last time, so disagreed again, and that's fine. Sandy raised concerns about the usefulness of the information, and that's also fine, except we're trying to interpret what the standards say, not what we wish they said, which was the point Sue raised. That was the difficulty that the board had.
Should we go through the questions?
I guess I would add, I understand that, but the reality of it is we're interpreting what the standard says, and I guess the standard produces numbers that may not be useful, but in some way we need to translate them to be useful because we haven't figured out what the equity method
right.
and this is supposed to do.
And so, I believe that when we, in our earlier discussions, we also said that it was important to deal with this question, and I would refer to the broader question rather than the narrower one that Sue thinks is particularly important. Now, because we didn't think the equity method project promised a timeline that would give practice a solution to this problem in any reasonable amount of time, and that's not a criticism of the board, that's just the way the process works and the challenge of figuring out what equity method means in the first place. So rather than asking the specific questions that the staff raised, I would like a show of hands of those who continue to support moving ahead with this interpretation. Show of hands.
My hand is up.
Sandy's hand is up.
Ten.
How many, then let me rephrase. How many of you, based on what you know today, would object?
Two.
Okay. That gives us what we need. So we, now, then, can we ask the question the staff asked? Question one is recommendation that we've already dealt with that one. Yes, you allocate, but we need to tell them how and the steps more explicitly. So I think we have the answer to question one. Question two was whether or not we need new disclosure requirements, and I didn't get a clear direction from the committee on that. Bruce?
I thought Sue's recommendation was a good one. Let's put it into the, let's try and link it to IFRS 12. Let's see where we get to on that, but maybe ask a specific question and say, do we think additional discussion?
Point well taken.
Yeah.
All right, so we will raise the question in the invitation to comment and deal with it that way.
You know, one thing that's important to me is that we, because when we apply IFRS 12 and IFRS 9 in the disclosures, each one of these things will be handled individually. Is there anything in IFRS 12 that says we must look at the disclosures related to all of these instruments together because the accounting ties them together? That's an important element of connecting the dots of how this works to the people who are actually using the financial statements. And I'm not certain that theme will be reflected in the disclosure requirements, because it's one instrument, one disclosure.
Yeah, I mean, Sandy, I can't make any promises at the minute. We'll see where we get to in drafting,
yeah.
But I think in linking to the objective in IFRS 12, that's our intention somehow, that by doing that, we'll encourage people to join the dots together, in a sense, in their disclosure.
All right. Question three, we've also wandered into.
Excuse me, before moving on to question three, can I make a comment on question one? So everybody agreed that we should also address how to allocate
right.
impairment.
Yeah.
What I want to ask to everyone is, would everybody be comfortable if the if the clarification would be to follow the same order that is specified in paragraph 38, that is in the reverse order of seniority.
Yeah, I thought that was the point, with the exception of our two objectors. Okay, as I say, our discussion has also leaked into question three. Gosh, is there anything else you wanted to say about that?
Yes, I think a sense of the committee is that it is important to have an illustrative example in the draft interpretation. But the second question is whether you would prefer the revised example as included in Appendix A or the original example.
I thought the support was clearly for the revised example, but Bruce?
Yeah, I was going to say I definitely support the revised one. I mean, the only comment I had was, I know some people thought it was too complex. I think it's at the right level of complexity. I mean, we need to understand the different permutations that are there. I don't know how to get better. The only one comment I had very quickly was, when I looked at the appendix where we had the revised example, I found I had to actually go back to the body of the paper to pick up some of the explanations. So I found that there was a lot of really good stuff in the explanation in the body of the paper that I think you could put into that. And because I think just putting journals is going to be difficult. We need to explain more what we're doing. This is difficult to understand. So I was going to say, I think it's all there. So just from a drafting point of view, I'll bring some into it.
Okay, Bertrand, I'll get back to you. Young Su?
I just want to make sure whether the staff will include an example about the impairment of net investment, which is missing in this example, in the final example.
I understand that it does not have an illustration of additional impairment upon IS-28, but as everybody just now agreed that if you follow the same order in which you apply when you allocate your share of losses, I think we'll be making effectively the same example, because when you recognize an impairment upon IS-28, you first allocate it to the equity account of investments. And then, if there's any remaining, you allocate it to the long-term interest. So I think that would be this same point we try to make through allocation of losses.
I'll just add to that maybe that when we prepare these examples, the reason we haven't in one illustration gone through all three steps. Is because we actually think that if we say it's a case where the loss allocation is so much that you start to allocate losses against long-term interests, that means your equity method investment has already gone to zero. We think that from economically in reality, it would be incredibly, incredibly, incredibly rare that you would ever possibly get an IS-28 impairment loss that would effectively get allocated to the long-term interests. Just by virtue of the fact that the equity method investment has already gone to zero, you've already allocated losses such that your long-term interest is now written down to a lower value than your IFRS 9 measure, which is either fair value or includes expected credit losses. So to get an IS-28 impairment loss, where you're testing that for the wider unit of account and taking into account more future cash flows, it's just that economically we think that would just be so rare that it would happen, that our experience in the past with illustrative examples is that if we illustrate something that is a kind of non-economic scenario, people get so distracted with the fact it's not an economic scenario that they miss the point being made. So that's why we didn't put it into this example. If I think you think it's important to illustrate IS-28 impairment, then I'd suggest that it's an example that doesn't have loss allocation. So it just is some long-term interest, and then it would have IS-28 impairment. The but I put to that is then the IS-28 impairment wouldn't really be anything to do with long-term interest, though, which would be the subject of the interpretation. It would be entirely illustrating IS-28 impairment in the context of the equity method investment, because all it would show would be you writing down your equity method investment and impairing that. So that's the, we could do that, but then it's actually nothing to do with impairing long-term
interest.
I think
that's a good idea. I haven't thought about, you know, how to include the impairment from IAS 36 onto this example. But if it is too complex, I think it's going to be very complex. So I think both of the ideas are very good. You know, Mr. Yamagami said, you know, we can say the allocation of IAS 36 is the same as the allocation of IAS 28. And also, as Patricia said, we can give another example without allocation of IAS 28 if it becomes much complex. Then this interpretation is going to be complete.
Well, my only point in that is, to me, if we added the second illustration with IAS 28 impairment, it's not really directly the subject of the interpretation. The interpretation is to tell you how to account for long-term interest, and that would be more illustrating impairment of the equity method.
I think we're wandering here. Bob and then Bertrand.
Okay. Mine actually goes beyond the example. I think it's really important to point out to people that this is an interpretation, not an amendment. We've talked a bit about the double counting of losses, and I know we've convinced ourselves that, well, because there are two different units of account, there's not double counting. Well, there really is double counting of the exposure. We're double counting not with the IFRS 9 impairment and the IAS 28 impairment. We're double counting with the IFRS 9 impairment and the allocation of losses under 28. If you were able to freeze assumptions after you've taken the IFRS 9 and then allocated losses, you were able to freeze assumptions and they worked out exactly as it is. Well, IFRS 9 makes you count for something as if, okay, those are the expected, what you're going to expect to return. Your expected return. If you actually got that, well, you're going to have a gain because you're reversing then the losses under the equity method. So we do have a double counting. And we recognize that there's a problem with equity method accounting. And we're probably best to do an amendment and just eliminate the, you know, allocation to long-term interest. But I thought we decided that, you know, that's the board's project. They've got a research project, a pipeline project on equity method. And so we're just going to interpret. Because I don't think if we don't recognize that this is really an interpretation of what is actually there, the user, the readers, the constituents, when they implant, when they come back, they're gonna kill us and tell us.
Yeah. Okay, Bertrand.
I agree with Jungo on the fact that because I was maybe not clear enough when I stated that, referring to the example. But if I have personally to answer to the question, the question one, I think that the draft interpretation should clarify that an entity should allocate an impairment loss recognized on the net investment first to the investment accounted for using the equity method, and then to the other assets, as it is the case in IAS 36. Because once there is an impairment loss recognized in IAS 28, you effectively assess whether or not you have a trigger event for an impairment using the requirements in IAS 39, IFRS 9. But once you have a trigger event, the whole evaluation is in accordance with IAS 36. And why? It's just because there is, even though it's not distinguished on the balance sheet, there is a goodwill attached to the value of the investment accounted for using the equity method. So I understand that many dislike that, but it's written in IAS 28. So then I think allocation would be, to my mind, not the proper answer. If we refer to what is done in IAS 36, where you first allocate any impairment to goodwill, and then if there is an extra amount, you allocate that to the other assets. So there it would be the same. First the investment, and then any other long-term interest.
And we intend that your answer to question one said that in the interpretation we will explain that allocation.
Okay.
So it's just a question then of whether you think you want
okay.
it illustrated.
Okay. I was wondering because as I'm new and I know there have been many, many discussions so far, so difficult for me to jump at the very end of it. Sorry about that.
I think the answer, what I hear from the committee is, oh, Tony, you want help. You want me to help me.
I'm not sure this is necessarily helpful. To answer the question, yes, I support the example. I just have a question that I don't know the answer to, and I don't particularly want to debate today, but maybe I could leave it to the staff as they work through it. One of the things you're required to do under IAS 28 is recognise your share of an associate's OCI. Are there any implications for what we have worked through of there being significant amounts of associates' OCI to be recognised? I don't off the top of my head know the answer to the question, but you could end up, for example, with, let's say the associate makes a loss, but there's a significant gain goes through OCI, maybe it's CTA and the associate or something like that, or vice versa. And I haven't worked through the bookkeeping to figure out whether or not it makes, or it has an impact. But I just wondered whether it would be worth thinking about whether it would have an impact.
To that point, I think it would add another complexity to
this. I understand. I'm not suggesting that we necessarily need to put anything in.
Yeah.
It was so, more at least understand whether it would have an impact. I wasn't saying the example is complicated enough, I agree.
Yeah. So I think what you're saying, Tony, and we're happy to do that, we'll kind of run through the numbers, add in where there might be OCI, potentially if it's helpful, send it round to committee members so you can see that. I agree, I wouldn't want to include it as part of the illustration, but just make sure we thought about it in drafting the interpretation.
Okay, other than that, I'm hearing general support. Mm-hmm. Transition?
Okay, transition requirements. Transition requirements are discussed in paragraphs 42 to 50 of the paper. For all entities, including insurance companies, applying the temporary exemption from IFRS 9, we recommend that the draft interpretation should A, require retrospective application of the proposals, but permit an entity not to restate comparative information, apply the interpretation, unless an entity chooses to restate the comparative information on initial application of IFRS 9. If an entity chooses to restate the comparative information, apply the interpretation, but not IFRS 9, the entity has to apply IAS 39 to long-term interest in the comparative information. The handout we distributed yesterday summarizes these proposals, and if time permits, I'd like to walk through the handout to explain what this means in practice.
Sorry, just to check, does everybody have a copy of the handout?
So starting from the top, in variation 1, an entity chooses to restate the comparatives applying IFRS 9. And if an entity chooses to do so, our proposal is that the entity must do the same applying the interpretation. So in this case, both current and comparative periods reflect IFRS 9. And in variation 2, capital A, an entity chooses not to restate the comparatives applying IFRS 9 and the interpretation. In this situation, the current period reflects IFRS 9, but what's included in the comparative information depends on how the entity previously accounted for long-term interests. And in variation 2, capital B, an entity chooses not to restate the comparatives applying IFRS 9, but chooses to do so applying the interpretation. In this situation, the comparative period should reflect IAS 39, irrespective of how the entity previously accounted for long-term interest. This is because the interpretation clarifies that financial instrument standards apply to long-term interest. And variations 3 and 4 are possible transitions for those insurance companies applying the temporary exemption from IFRS 9. And these are equivalent to variations to capital A and to capital B for non-insurance companies. Instead of IFRS 9, the current period reflects IAS 39. Does anybody have any question on these proposals?
Comments? Sue?
I'm allowed to ask, but just to be sure. So the variation 2B,
mm-hmm.
so So this is somebody who's applying IFRS 9 in 2018, but decided generally not to restate comparatives, so it's not going to apply IFRS 9 in the comparatives. But they could, if they hadn't previously been applying IAS 39, then they would start to apply 39 in the comparatives just to these long-term interests.
Yes.
Okay. So it doesn't mean that they could choose to apply IFRS 9 in the comparatives just for the long-term interests. It just means they can choose to apply the old FI literature in the comparatives.
Yeah.
Just matter of personal opinion, I'm not sure if there's much benefit in that alternative. Yeah. Or whether you'd be rather better just to say you either restate your comparatives to get it onto FI land and then you follow whether or not you've restated IFRS 9 comparatives generally or not, and you do the same thing with the long-term interest. But
I think you're probably right that that variation 2B, it's probably going to be pretty rare that somebody would actively choose that, in a sense, actually choose to say I'll restate comparatives to 39.
And so... Right. 2A, they're all doing catch-up adjustments, yeah? At the beginning of the current period.
Yes.
Yep.
Mary?
I think a personal view, when I was reading this paper and thinking about the range of options, the complexity, you know, of the mechanics in this interpretation, I was challenging myself and the staff about whether or not the relief from retrospective application, it makes sense. I understand the staff's point, and I think the chart is helpful in looking at it, is if you mandated retrospective application, it would mean that the comparatives period with the two places where we have other would flip to presumably IS 39. Now, one of the things that the staff has said in its analysis is that think that this has, well, it's an existing question, has not been a big issue to date because the difference between IS 39 and other is not so great. So presumably it isn't that big step. Second, by publishing the draft interpretation, any question about will people have enough notice to connect to collect the requisite information, I think puts people in on warning. And while there will be some disconnect of the type that you see in variation 2B of IS 39 in one period and IFRS 9 in another period, it first of all reduces the range of possible mixes of approaches, and it's easier to explain that you're either accounting for it under your old or your new financial instruments guidance. So I think in terms of the complexity of what the interpretation is trying to explain to people and the number of possible variations, it might be wise to limit it, you know, limit the range somewhat by requiring retrospective application of this interpretation. And I think that would mean if you're not restating your comparatives for IFRS 9, then you are you're just requiring application of 39 in that previous period. This just seems to go, you know, by putting a third variant in, creating so many alternatives that it's hard to explain. And if IS 39 versus other is not that big a deal, then just get it cleaned up.
Yeah, Sue.
Sorry, and I must say that when I looked at this, even though I'm a IFRS 9 geek, I had to sort of put a hot towel on my head to think through what the heck it all meant. But I guess my only reservation with what you've just said, Mary, is that because IFRS 9 itself is applied retrospectively, even if you don't restate comparatives, you have to think about whether these long-term interests have significantly increased in credit risk since you originally recognised them. If they haven't applied IFRS 9 in the comparatives, they have to apply IAS 39 in the comparative period. In effect, we're telling them they have to think about both IAS 39 in order to prepare the comparatives, but also IFRS 9 in order to work out what the retrospective effect is for the cumulative catch-up adjustment. So in a sense, I think we'd be asking them to apply two sets of FI literature retrospectively in order to prepare A, the comparatives, and B, to get you onto IFRS 9. So I think it would double the work.
So I think what you're saying, Sue, is that's the justification for what's in 2A. There is a question about whether we want to keep 2B, because maybe that's a, you know, a variation too far, because no one would want to.
Let's hear from some of the committee members. Young Sue?
I just wonder, what if we delay the effective date by 1 year to January 1st of 2019, 1 year after the effective date of IFRS 9, don't you think we can eliminate all IF 39 on this table? I have two reasons. The first one, maybe we can simplify the transition. The second one, I just think about the process of this project. You know, we have to, you know, they write down the draft, and then we have to go through the balloting process, and then the comment period. Maybe this is going to be complete sometime in the middle of next year. So in 2018, January 1st seems to be, I don't want to use this, you know, the word, but seems to be too ambitious, too short amount of time. So you know, I'm asking this question for two reasons. We can simplify this transition in the dates at this table, and the second one, realistically, maybe 1 year delay might be more realistic.
I acknowledge that it is tight, but one of the important things that this interpretation becomes effective on 1st January 2018 is that people applied IFRS 9 to these long-term interests when IFRS 9 kicks in. And if it's deferred 1 year later, when people apply IFRS 9 in 2018 and they do not apply IFRS 9 to these long-term interests, but 1 year later, when the interpretation comes out, they now have to apply IFRS 9, I think that's going to be create a burden.
Certainly a burden to users. Sue?
Yeah, there's one really, you're right, we're pushing it time-wise. But I think that one of the massive benefits of aligning the effective dates is that there's a whole load of transition reliefs in IFRS 9 for people if they come into IFRS 9 with existing financial instruments that simplify how you work out what your starting position is for expected credit loss accounting. If people come in after that transition period, they've already initially applied IFRS 9, all of those transition reliefs that are in IFRS 9 have expired. So they're going to have to come in and they have to, hand on heart, absolutely be able to work out whether they've got significant increases in credit risk or not, which is hard to do with stuff you've held for a long time. So we hoped that there was a benefit in allowing them to incorporate it in their bigger implementation efforts, but also with the transition reliefs that come in with it. If we come in with a later date, we could, in theory, you know, provide a whole load of transition reliefs, but then this interpretation is going to have transition reliefs that are five times as long as the interpretation. So that was the other reason, sort of just to build on why it's quite neat if we can align them. I guess the other thing you could do would be to allow early application. Then if you wanted the benefit of the transition relief, you could come in early, but if you thought it was too hard, you could go in later, but knowing that you're going to have a harder transition process than otherwise.
May I suggest that we raise this in the invitation to comment? Yeah. That seems the reasonable approach. If people are really troubled by it, we'll hear anyway, but this, let's focus their attention. Okay. And first-time adopters?
For first-time adopters, we basically recommend the same transition requirements. They would have to apply the interpretation retrospectively, but if they choose not to receive the comparative information relating to IFRS 9, they also have an option not to receive the comparative information apply the interpretation. Now, the question relating to transition requirements is summarized on page 14, and it asks whether you agree with these recommendations.
I think we just answered that. And I think we've also answered effective date. question five.
Yes.
Which leaves you with the question that I asked a while back, but I think we have to ask it formally, and that's permission to ballot.
Yes. So question six and seven on page 17 formally ask whether you are satisfied that you have addressed all relevant matters in developing the draft interpretation, and whether you agree that the staff should prepare a ballot draft of the proposed draft interpretation.
Show of hands. This is for preparation of a ballot draft, not based on whether or not you plan to object to it, but do you agree we should move ahead and prepare it so that you can vote against it? Sandy, yeah, Sandy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have nothing. I'm sorry, I didn't, was it a question or did you have a question for me to add something? I'm sorry.
No, it was a question. Do you agree that we should have addressed all relevant matters and should proceed with to prepare a ballot draft?
Yes.
Yeah. Carl?
I'm only not sure if we have addressed the OCI IS-21 issue already. I think we should discuss before.
I think we said what we do, if it's okay, is that we'll work through some numbers to see that. We're happy to share that with you by email so you see that, and then to ensure we take that into account when we draft the interpretation.
Yeah, I think that's how I remember it, too.
Remark, I come too late in the process here, so I vote neither against, neither in favor of balloting. I mean, I cannot express any specific view on that.
Well, at this point, I would hope, yeah, I understand that. The forget our due process. Is
no more than four objects.
No more than four objects. So abstain in this situation is not the same as objecting. Martin?
Sorry for that. I only have one comment with regard to the proposed effective date, 1st of January 2018. So if I go along the timeline, we are doing the pre-balloting now, and then if the standard probably, the interpretation, sorry, probably comes out in 2017.
Yeah.
Early 2017. Right?
We think we could get the draft interpretation out before the end of this year.
Yeah. So the interpretation will be out in 2017.
Yes.
And it has to be endorsed within the European Union. So it could be a quite, well, tough timeline. And then preparers might, and also auditors might be in a situation, well, whether it is endorsed or not. I mean, the good thing is we are only talking about an interpretation. So you might argue, okay, it's in a way I would have done it anyhow. But in general, one could also consider to have application date 2019 with early application encouraged. So that would more or less from a, from endorsement perspective probably help, just as a comment to consider.
It's a valid comment. We had not thought, I had not thought through the obstacle of endorsement, which typically adds a couple of months at a minimum.
Yeah. I mean, and it,
no, I understand.
So I think what we've already said, we all agree that it's very tight, and I think Sue, you know, Takashi and Sue explained the reasons why we're going. I think there's two ways we could go. We could definitely expose the date, expose that we want 2018, and specifically ask the question and see what people say, because then they can tell us whether they think it's too tight, or go the other way. I think I'd almost prefer, but if it's up to committee to go that route, let's try for 28 for all of, you know, and explain all of the reasons why we think that's a good starting point. For me personally as well, the other reason that lining it up with the initial application of IFRS 9 made sense is actually because one of the other views we heard that gets applied in practice, it was formerly what we talked about, View D, actually described a method of applying this that simply doesn't work in the context of IFRS 9. So one of the other application things said you would look at classification and measurement in 9, not impairment, which simply sort of can't mechanically work in 9. So it just said there was another reason to suggest that if you're applying this interpretation, it makes sense to sort of apply it at the same time you first apply IFRS 9.
I think we have to raise it in the invitation to comment. All right, let's wrap this up. Tony?
I was simply going to say, I think that this people will soon separate.
Sorry.
I was simply going to say, given what Sue explained and Patrina's perspective, I think we just have to shoot for 2018, and if we can't get there, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
We always expose hard and back off. It's easier than exposing easy and then trying to up the game. So, all right, we are way behind schedule. Let's take a 10-minute break. I'm sure glad I suggested that we move the admin session.
Yes, that was good. We didn't expect to.
I think that we have to close it now. So I guess we need to pick which of these. I'd rather finalize rather than introduce an
option. It's just that.
I don't see either Kumar or Marion.
I should be coming, so we should speak to them.
Get their call on which they want to do, but my preference is always to finish work rather than adding more.
Well, yeah, that would be the logical way to.
Oh, I guess I want the microphone to say.
Cash flows, but the 28 cash flows arguably include the same conceptual cash flow. So I understand now that.
So it's just when you do the line, and that's when you do on the screen plan. So when you do the line, you start from the beginning. So ignore any law complications. So you have to take it. However, when you come along, you do it again. You look at the line and what you do. You know what I mean? It's only in doing
9. That's right. That's what's happening in
28. But when you come back in 28, you can keep doing it again before 28, which is where you.
So I guess if you compared in year 1, you arguably will be below, if your carrying amount will be below fair value for the 9. Then in year 2, you consider the fair value is the same number as it was last year,